2 weeks ago, we reviewed the structure of Exodus. As I argued then, we should see it beginning with a prologue and then continuing on with two parallel panels, each of which I divided into five sections. So we have the prologue, verses 1 through 7, and then we have panel 1, the Lord delivers Israel from service to Pharaoh, that takes place in chapters 1 through 13. And then we have panel 2, the Lord enables Israel to serve him. The first panel is who is going to be Israel's father? Is it going to be Pharaoh or is it going to be God? And the second panel is what kind of son is Israel going to be? The topic we talked about this morning in the sermon is very, very relevant for the book of Exodus. So in our time together tonight, we'll work through the prologue and begin to deal with the first section of the first panel. So extending from 1:8 through 2:25, so 1:8 after the prologue to the end of chapter 2, this first section tells the story of how Moses was delivered through water, driven into the wilderness, and brought to the mountain of God. And chapter 1 is divided into three paragraphs of 7 verses each. So you have a 7-verse prologue, then you have paragraph 1 of the main sort of body, and then you have paragraph 2, and then verse 22 is a sort of transitional thing that gives a sneak preview of what's about to come in the next chapter. Well, we'll see how far we get. I'm hoping to work through the first two of these paragraphs in our time tonight. I'd originally planned on working through the whole chapter, but the material began to accumulate, and I thought that might be overambitious. So we'll see if we even get through the first 14 verses tonight. But one of the things I just wanted to point out at the beginning is when I'm preaching, I'm trying to put the work in to say, this is what the Lord has to say to us this morning. And so it's not a dialogue. It's not a conversation. It's, as far as I can tell, based on my study of the Word of God, this is what God has to say to us. And certainly I also want to put study in when I'm teaching, but it's a different purpose. We'll be talking in our Sunday night series about the different elements of what we do as a church. But when there's teaching, there's more the occasion to have conversation, to ask questions, for me to ask questions of you, for you to ask questions of me, to have comment and conversation about how it might apply to our life. So it's a different sort of thing. Obviously, they're related. There's overlap. There's certainly some teaching in the course of preaching. At least I try to, you know, teach while I'm preaching. And there's certainly some application and some thus saith the Lord in the context of teaching. But the focus is different, and that's the distinction that I would make between preaching a sermon and teaching a lesson. When you're preaching a sermon, you start somewhere, you go somewhere, and if you cut it off in the middle, something should be seriously lacking, because a sermon is a unitary whole. It's a journey, as it were, and you need to come to the destination. When we're teaching through the text, we can chop it off early or chop it off later because we're basically just working through the text and we're making observations as we go along. So there's some differences in the way that I would see teaching and the way I would see preaching. And so what I would encourage you to do is to be thinking of questions that you want to ask. I'm not going to promise I'll always have an answer for you, but I will do my best. And questions and things you would want to ask, and be paying attention because I'm going to ask you all questions as well as we get into this. But before we get into the text proper, let's have a word of prayer. Father, I come before you and I thank you for your goodness. I thank you for this opportunity to teach your word, and I pray that you would be glorified. I pray, Father, Lord, you give us ears to hear. You'd give me wisdom to speak. In Christ's name I pray. Amen. Well, if you don't have your Bibles open already, go ahead and open them to Exodus chapter 1 and verse 1. As we mentioned last week, the first 7 verses form a brief prologue, just as Genesis begins with a prologue in chapter 1:1 through 2:3. So Exodus begins with a briefer prologue that lays down the foundation for the story that follows. And as we shall see, there's an entire network of connections in these verses that draws us back to the text of Exodus, text of Genesis, pardon me. Exodus 1:1. Now, these are the names of the children of Israel, which came into Egypt. Every man in his household came with Jacob. In Hebrew, that's Va'ela Shemot, and these are the names.
Shemot is the title of the book in Hebrew. So in Hebrew, in the Hebrew Old Testament, names often books often take their name from the first word or the first couple of words in the book. So Genesis begins, Bereshit bara, in the beginning created, Bereshit bara Elohim, in the beginning God created. And so the name of Genesis in Hebrew is Bereshit. It's the first word. It means in the beginning. And so we see a similar pattern in Exodus about Elah. That just means and these. And then you have Shemot. That's the first main word. It means names. And so the title of Exodus is names in Hebrew. Now these are the names. And literally, I already pointed this out, but it would be and these are the names. So it begins with a conjunction. It begins with the word and. And that's not good English style, but the point is that there's a connection between Exodus and Genesis. It literally starts with the word and. So in order to understand Exodus, you have to have your mind on Genesis and what's already taken place. But this isn't just a conjunction saying, okay, we're starting this new book. Make sure you don't forget what we covered in Genesis. It is that. But this also, and these are the names, is a direct quote from Genesis chapter 46, Genesis 46, 8. And these are the names of the children of Israel, which came into Egypt. So it's both connecting us back to Genesis in general, and it's also bringing us back to a specific passage in Genesis, Genesis 46. Now, these are the names of the children of Israel. The phrase translated as children of Israel is literally in Hebrew, B'nai Yisrael, and the word B'nai means sons, literally. So it's the sons of Israel. Now, of course, the reason why most translations call it children is because the phrase B'nai Yisrael doesn't just include boys, it includes boys and girls too. It includes all of the children of Israel, but at the same time, this language of sonship, as we covered this morning, is very, very crucial. And so it's important that we recognize when we read the phrase children of Israel, it's talking about the sons of Israel. And there's a theme that goes all throughout the Old Testament and indeed into the New Testament of sonship that we wouldn't want to miss. And so we get a reference to the sons of Israel in verse 1. And then if we were to skip down to verse 7, we get another reference to the sons of Israel. Now, I said this I was sick last week, and we heard something from Brother Josh on missions that was really a blessing. About 2 weeks ago, I said one of the ways that a Hebrew narrative will mark sections out is by having a phrase at the beginning of a section, having a phrase at the end of a section. So there's this sort of a recap, there's a repetition, and that helps you mentally to know, okay, we started by talking about the sons of Israel, we have another mention of the sons of Israel, we've got a section, now we're going to move on to a new section, and that's sort of a structural technique. But there's something else that takes place. You have the sons of Israel in verse 1, and the sons of Israel in verse 1 are a family. But the sons of Israel in verse 7 are a nation. So we have a transference from what started out as a single large family has now become its own nation. And the sons of Israel hereafter is going to primarily refer to the nation of Israel. So we've got, now these are the names of the children of Israel which came into Egypt. Now, what was the first time that Israel's ancestor went to Egypt? Does anyone remember? Brother Tanaka. Yes, and what happened when Abraham went down to Egypt? Petey? Well, that's when he went up. But what happened? So he when he left Egypt, he took wealth with him, right? What's something else that happened? Sarah? That was when he lied to Pharaoh. And what happened? What happened to Sarah? So she got taken under, she was placed under the control of Pharaoh. And what happened to Pharaoh when he tried to control Sarah? Anyone else? Brother Nate? There were plagues. So Abram goes down to Egypt. Sarah ends up under the control of Pharaoh. Pharaoh gets plagues, and Abraham leaves Egypt with gold and silver. Does that sound familiar? So Abraham goes up out of the land with great wealth derived from the Egyptians. So we talked about, last time we talked about how the story of Moses prefigures the story of Israel. Well, this prefiguring goes back even earlier to the story of Abraham, where Abraham, the ancestor of Israel, has a similar experience. So if you've already read Genesis and you know about how Abraham goes down, there's plagues, there's wealth, you're already primed to hear a particular type of story. So it's an echo. It's like a symphony. When a symphony will introduce a particular theme, but in many symphonies, and I'm not a symphony composer, so I don't know all the technical terms, but I do like to listen to good music. And one of the things that will happen is there'll be a particular theme, and you will hear a little portion of the theme, and then that'll be echoed again, and it'll be echoed again, it'll be developed until you get to the grand finale when it pulls together everything that's taken place before, and you have this sense of fulfillment and completion. That's what takes place in the Gospels, where all these stories that have been echoed and echoed one another, and there's become a certain degree of dissonance that needs to be resolved. And when Christ comes, he's that note that resolves all the other notes that had come before. And it really, really is quite remarkable. And we have to learn to hear even the advance echoes to be able to capture all that's going on in the Gospels. So now in verses 2-4, we get the names. So these are the names. What are the names? Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin. Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. Now every detail of the text tells us something. We don't always know what that something is, but in this case, we do. What do you think the significance of the ands are? Because you've got Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. So one and for four names. Then you have Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin. You have one and for three names. Then you have Dan and Naphtali. Then you have Gad and Asher. What's the significance of that? Does anyone have any idea? There's a particular pattern with the names, and those ands are breaking them into groups. But what is the significance of those groups? It's because of their mothers. So Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, those were the four sons that Leah had first before anyone else had sons. Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin are the sons that Leah had. Well, Issachar and Zebulun were Leah's later sons, and Benjamin was Rachel's sons. So you have the first block of Leah's sons. Then you have the second block of sons from Leah and Rachel. And then you have Dan and Naphtali, which are the sons of Rachel's handmaid Bilhah, and then Gad and Asher are the sons of Leah's handmaid Zilpah. Now, why am I drawing attention to this seemingly little detail? Well, while verse 1 contains a direct quote from Genesis 46, so there's a lot of parallels in the language to the genealogy, the mention of Jacob's sons in Genesis 46, the particular way of arranging the names takes us back to Genesis 35. As one commentator helpfully explains, the sons, that is, the tribes of Israel, are listed within a formulaic framework found in verse 1 and 4 that is clearly adapted from Genesis 46. Yet the order of the names does not follow the one given in that chapter. Instead, it's based on Genesis 35. And there is a good reason for this seeming anomaly. For this latter chapter, that is Genesis 35, contains the divine blessing to Jacob. So by alluding, by the list of the names, by the way the names are arranged, it is connecting back to Genesis 35, because that's where the blessing occurs, and there's going to be another connection to the blessing. And we'll see that, and we'll actually read through that blessing here in a few minutes. We'll get to why that's significant in a minute, but let's move on to the next verse for now. And all the souls that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls, for Joseph was in Egypt already. Now, came out of the loins is sort of a strange way of putting things. We wouldn't use that normally. And it's kind of a strange way of putting things in Hebrew, too, to be honest. But the word that's translated as loins is the very same word translated as thigh in Genesis 32. What happens in Genesis 32? Jacob's thigh, who touches it? Noah. No, not Joseph. Though that does happen later on in Genesis, so that's a good memory. But what is it that happens what? The angel disjoints his thigh. It's where he receives the name of Israel. So by saying they came out of the loins or the thigh of Jacob, there's a specific allusion being made back to Genesis 32, where he receives the name of Israel. And this is the story of the sons of Israel, how the sons of Israel became a nation. They became a nation because of God's blessing and naming and promise to Jacob. Genesis 32, 25, and when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh or loins, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh or loins was out of joint as he wrestled with him. So, let's see, where are we? And all the souls that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls. This total of 70, so we mentioned the order of the names that are listed comes from Genesis 35. But the total of 70 comes from Genesis 46. And when we went through Genesis 46 in our series on Genesis, we spent a good deal of time working how the numbers add up to 70. And they do add up to 70 if you pay careful attention to the details. This number is significant because it's used to make a number of connections in both the Old and the New Testament. So the table of nations contained in Genesis 10 contains how many nations? Anyone? 70. 70 is significant. Genesis 10 contains 70. And it's not a coincidence that the sons of the house of Jacob also total 70. It's just one hint among many that God has not forgotten his promise that the call of Abraham would be the means of blessing the nations through his descendants. Now, you wouldn't build a whole argument based on just that one connection, right? That would be a really weak basis to base anything significant on. But the fact is, and we developed this when we worked through Genesis, there are many, many, many connections, both in the details and in the main thrust of the text that shows that the family of Abraham was always intended to be a microcosm, as it were, a platform through which God was going to bless all the nations of the world. It was to be the new humanity of God. And of course, therefore, when Jesus sends out 70 disciples in the Gospel of Luke, a gospel that specifically deals with his interactions with the Gentiles more than any other gospel, we know that something is afoot. There's a new microcosm being developed through which the nations are going to be blessed. And the reference to the 70 sons of Jacob connects to this narrative thread from Genesis. Verse 5, and Joseph died and all his brethren and all that generation. Once again, this connects us to the end of Genesis. And Joseph said unto his brethren, I die, and God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land unto the land which he sware to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And Joseph took an oath of the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and ye shall carry up my bones from hence. So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. So the reference to the death of Joseph is reminding us that they're in Egypt, but they're not supposed to stay in Egypt. God's plan was for them to get up out of Egypt at the right point in time. Verse 7, and the children of Israel, I mentioned we had the sons or the children of Israel, verse 1. Verse 7, rounding out this prologue, were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now in this verse, we find in Hebrew 7 expressions for the increase of the children of Israel. So they were fruitful, paru. They increased abundantly, they teemed or they swarmed, vasharitsu. So we have they're fruitful, they're swarming all over the place, they're multiplying, that's number 3. The next few are a little trickier because 3 separate Hebrew words are translated by a single expression in English, and waxed exceeding mighty. So that waxed exceeding mighty, you have number 4 in our list. They became mighty. So it's the verb, they became mighty, vayatsmu. and then with strength, bemoed, and then strongly, moed. So you have seven different words that each of them are contributing something. Well, that's actually number six, is strongly, and then you have, and the land was filled with them. So you have seven different expressions, all of which combine to say the land was swarming with Israelites. They were being fruitful, they were multiplying, they were filling the earth. Now these words, as many of you will be aware, intentionally take us back to the language of Genesis 1, the commission given to Adam and Eve. Genesis 9, the repetition of that commission to Noah and his family. Genesis 17, the promise to Abraham that God would see to it that this commission was fulfilled through and in his descendants. And Genesis 35, the repetition of this promise to Jacob and Israel. So let's briefly review these connections. Genesis chapter 1, verse 27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply. These words are key in Exodus 1:7. Israel was fruitful and Israel multiplied. This was the commission given to Adam and Eve. And replenish the earth. Now, replenish the earth is a perfectly accurate translation of the Hebrew here, but it obscures a crucial connection between the Genesis account and our text in Exodus. The ESV translates this phrase, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Do you see the connection? In Exodus 1:7, it says the land was filled with them. Well, the connection in Hebrew, though, is even stronger because the word that's translated as earth in Genesis 1 and the word that's translated as land in Exodus 1 is the same word, eretz, land or earth, and the difference of how it gets translated into English depends on context. So when it says they were filling the land, those are exactly the same words that are used in Genesis 1 when Adam and Eve were told to fill the earth. This is a direct connection back to the commission given to Adam and Eve. And subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. So we'll deal with the rest of the connections in Genesis more briefly. Moving on to Genesis 9, and you be fruitful and multiply, bring forth abundantly in the earth and multiply therein. In this one verse in Genesis 9, this is the commission given to Noah after they exit the ark. We have no less than four of the seven expressions that are used in Exodus. We come now to Genesis 17. For the sake of time, we'll read only the crucial verses 2 and 6, 17:2. I'll make my covenant between me and thee and will multiply thee exceedingly. Genesis 17:6, and I will make thee exceedingly fruitful. And I will make nations of thee and kings shall come out of thee. And what's so important about Genesis 17 is that God told Adam, be fruitful and multiply. And God tells Abraham and Isaac and Jacob to be fruitful and multiply too. But in addition to giving them a command, he gives them a divine promise. He says to them, I will make you fruitful and I will multiply you. What was before a simple command is now also, it's still a command, but it's also a divine promise to Abraham and to Abraham's descendants. For our purposes this evening, though, the last stop is Genesis 35. As I mentioned earlier, the order of the sons of Jacob in verses 2 through 4 has already alluded to Genesis 35. And God appeared unto Jacob again when he came out of Paddan Aram and blessed him. And God said unto him, thy name is Jacob, thy name shall not be called anymore Jacob, but Israel shall be thy name. This is the second time he receives the name of Israel. He received it in Genesis 32 when the angel touches his thigh. He receives it again in chapter 35. And he called his name Israel. And God said unto him, I am God Almighty, be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall be of thee, and kings shall come out of thy loins. And the land which I gave Abraham and Isaac to thee, I will give it, and to thy seed after thee will I give the lamb. So here's the point of all of this. All of these connections. It's that God's creational agenda is being fulfilled in the sons of Israel. So God has an agenda for his creation, and the children of Israel are fulfilling that agenda. Their multiplication that is taking place is in the fulfillment of the promises of God. Despite all the barren women, weak husbands, and all the other obstacles to the seed of the woman that we saw in Genesis, and if you want to understand what's going on in the book of Genesis, you wonder, why are all these wacky things taking place? Why can none of the women have children? And it seems like if there's some sort of misdeed that could be committed, it gets committed, and some of it is pretty sordid. Why all of that? It's because it's Murphy's Law. Everything that could go wrong does go wrong, and God still fulfills his promises. That's the point of the book of Genesis. And now we get to Exodus, and those promises, they're being fulfilled. And the seed of the serpent doesn't like it one little bit. Before we move on to the serpent's response to the success of the promises of God, any questions or comments on the first seven verses? On the prologue to Exodus, any questions or comments about that? Anyone? All right, we'll move on to verse 8. As with the first, our second paragraph also contains seven verses. And so we heard the story of how God was multiplying the children of Israel. Now we're going to see how Satan is going to try to stop that, stop the fulfillment of God's creational purposes. Verse 8. Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. Now, it's very important that the Pharaoh is not named. God could have supplied us with the details, but he didn't. And not giving the name of Pharaoh is a way of saying Pharaoh is a no-name nobody. So this was something that the Pharaohs were very familiar with. When they wanted to cast scorn on one of their predecessors, they would literally scrape their names off of the monuments. We know the Pharaohs did this. They would send people with chisels to chisel their names off of stone monuments so that they would no longer have a name. Well, this is what God is doing to Pharaoh, who thinks he's so high and mighty and he's going to thwart the creational purposes of God. God says, I'm going to name the Hebrew midwives, but I'm not going to name you, Pharaoh. There arose a new king which knew not Joseph. Pharaoh chose not to notice Joseph. It's almost inconceivable that he would have no knowledge of Joseph. He chose not to remember what Joseph had done. The last two verses of this section strikingly parallel this first verse. So the first section of the first panel goes from chapter 1:8 to the end of chapter 2. At the beginning of this section, we hear that Pharaoh chooses not to know Joseph. But Exodus 2:24 through 25, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham and Isaac and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God had respect unto them. The word translated in the King James as God had respect to them are in Hebrew simply God knew. Pharaoh did not know, did not want to know. God chose to know. God chose to remember. Though Pharaoh chose not to know what wasn't convenient for him to remember, God deliberately chose to remember his people in the place of affliction that they were in. Verse 9. And he said unto his people, behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Now, do you think that was true? Do you think that was actually true? There were more Israelites than there were Egyptians. They were multiplying into a nation, but do you really think that Pharaoh was telling the truth there? Anyone? Well, if there really were more Israelites than Egyptians, how would any of his policies work? They wouldn't. Pharaoh's exaggerating. If his statements had actually been true, his policies would have been completely ineffective. This fear motivates us to think that just and right responses are not enough, to think that we need power by any means necessary. Pharaoh is a master manipulator, and that's what he's being portrayed as, that he portrays this danger is so big, they're going to become bigger than us. That's actually probably not going to happen anytime soon. If they had actually been bigger, they wouldn't have been able to enslave them. And then he says unto his people, behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Now, Pharaoh was an absolute monarch who was treated as a god and ruled over his own people with a rod of iron. The interest of Pharaoh and the interest of Pharaoh's people did not have much alignment in reality. But Pharaoh is manipulating his people because he wants them to do something they shouldn't do. And so he identifies his interest with them. He says that he is going to fight for them and represent him, that his fear of being dispossessed of his kingdom should be their fear too. And this is the language of political manipulation in every age. Because of human fallenness, very rarely do the powerful, whatever political system and whatever political position they hold, actually have the interest of the common people at heart. That just isn't the case. Yet they almost always pretend like they do in order to manipulate the people into doing what serves their own interest. That's what Pharaoh is doing here. Here's the way one commentator put it. From the perspective of the narrator, the king's position is indefensible. He makes the Israelites out to be a threat without justification. He plays on the sense of insecurity which most populations feel when faced with those of a different ethnic origin. This us-them mentality is underlined by the way the king invites his own people to join him in dealing wisely with the Israelites. The king's deliberate use of we, us, and our suggests that it is in their common interest to act against the Israelites. According to the king, these foreign immigrants pose a threat, not simply to the throne, but to every Egyptian. This is exactly what Hitler did when he rose to power by portraying the Jews as a threat to the German way of life. He manipulated people into doing very horrific things because he portrayed them as these other people over there who are not like us and who pose a massive threat to us. And he dramatically exaggerated any possible threat that they posed. And because he persuaded people that he was on their side and that this threat was so enormous that the ordinary means of dealing with it were insufficient, he persuaded the German people to do truly horrific things. And that's exactly the same strategy that Pharaoh's using here. And it's exactly the same strategy that tyrants always use, because you need a lot of people to commit serious tyranny. So having exaggerated the danger and pretended to identify with the common Egyptian, the nameless Pharaoh is now ready to propose a solution. So he's got him in the palm of his hand. What's he going to do with him? Verse 10. Come on, let's deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them out of the land. Now, he's not being very consistent. If they were really more and mightier, why is Pharaoh's biggest concern that they're going to go up out of the land? This doesn't make any sense. And there really is a theme that runs through chapter 1, really runs through the whole section that deals with Pharaoh. Pharaoh proclaims himself as the wisest of all kings, but what he does is really stupid. And what he does doesn't make any sense. And he's constantly stepping on his own feet, contradicting himself, being foolish. So Pharaoh, the wise king, is foolish, but there's more going on here. So come on, he says. Now there's a fascinating connection here. For though the King James translates it differently, we have already seen the exhortation to come on, let us do something. So reading the phrases in the ESV, which translates them consistently, allows us to hear the allusion. So Genesis 11:3, and they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. And the word that's translated as come or come on is not a super common word. And then you have, come on, let's do this. That's an allusion back to Genesis 11. We're intended to connect the anti-creational agenda of the tower builders in Genesis 11 to the anti-creational agenda of Pharaoh in Exodus 1. In Exodus 1:10, when we read, come, let us deal wisely, this is an intentional allusion to the rebellious building project of the builders of Babel. As we shall see, it's by no means the only one. So here's one of the ways you can tell that the echoes that you're hearing are actually there. If you just notice one little thing, maybe you're noticing something that isn't there. But when there's one thing, and then there's another thing, and there's another thing, and then these same things are picked up later on in a different context, so you know they're echoes that get used more than once, then it starts to increase in volume, and you can tell something is going on, a connection is being made. That's the case here. We'll hear that second, that the additional connection here just very briefly. Come on, let's deal wisely with them. Wisdom is a key theme in the book of Exodus. Pharaoh pretends to be wise. He pretends to be shrewd. And in his pretended wisdom, he's going to lead his people to unjustly enslave the very children of Israel who had once saved them from famine. But there's more here, though. As we find in Proverbs, there's a strong connection between wisdom and creation. The Lord by wisdom hath founded the earth, by understanding hath he established the heavens. Later on in Exodus, there's a strong connection between wisdom and the building of the tabernacle. Now, we spent quite a bit of time 2 weeks ago talking about the connection between creation and the tabernacle. Well, there's a connection between wisdom and creation and wisdom in the tabernacle. That's one of the connections between the two. And I have given, this is Exodus 31, with him Aholiab, the son of Ahisamach, of the tribe of Dan, and in the hearts of all that are wise-hearted, I have put wisdom, that they may make all that I have commanded thee. That is, make the things for the tabernacle. So the tabernacle is constructed with wisdom, and creation is made with wisdom. Now we have Pharaoh's wisdom. What's going to be the result of Pharaoh's wisdom? Well, Pharaoh is not fearing the Lord. And the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. So we have a hint that things are not going to end well for Pharaoh. And though this is to get ahead of ourselves just a little bit, there's a strong contrast that's being set up between the pretended wisdom that builds Babel on the backs of Israelite slaves and the true wisdom that builds a tabernacle by the willing service of the redeemed Israelite nation. In every age, God delights to confound the wisdom of the so-called wise of this age. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? Pharaoh uses his so-called wisdom to justify his evil plan to enslave the sons of Israel. And while it'd be easy to list ways in which others in the world use pretended wisdom for self-justification, we must always remember that judgment begins at the house of God. It does us no good to list all the ways that the world is wicked. We already know that. We need to focus on the evils in which we are complicit. What are some of the ways in which we can use our wisdom to justify the wrongs that we wish to participate in? So Pharaoh, he's using wisdom to justify enslaving the sons of Israel. And he's saying, this is the wise, the prudent thing to do. Well, certainly we could point to examples of other people like Pharaoh who do that. The reality is that we face the same temptation to use wisdom to justify doing things that we know are not right. So what are the ways some of that temptation could show up in our own lives? In which we could think that it's prudent, it's wise, it's clever to do something that's wrong. Sherry? Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a wonderful example. So many times we're like, well, this isn't the right time. And sometimes it isn't the right time. But if it's never the right time, there's something wrong with that kind of prudence. And all of us are guilty of making, well, I suppose I can't speak for all of us, but certainly I've been guilty of making that kind of excuse. And I know it's a really easy one to make. What would be another example of that? Brother Nate? Yeah. I think that the temptation is, if I don't own them, to make justifications for like, hey, I've got to do whatever it takes to win this argument, even if it means leaving biblical ethics and love out the door. And that is especially a temptation on social media, that it's like, hey, I've got to slam that person. I've got to deal with that. I've got to be, you know, give a snarky comment about that. And we're like, well, if I do all that Sermon on the Mount stuff, then I'm going to appear weak and I want to appear strong. And that is a temptation that all of us face. And in fact, even if you're arguing against that, you face the temptation in wanting to make an overly strong argument against people making overly strong arguments. So you really can't get away from this temptation. April? Brother Rich?
Well, I think, you know, maybe another example would be like tithing. If I give God that money, I don't have that money to make more money. And then you say, well, I forfeit God's blessing because you're using human wisdom to try to figure out how to give God money. You're not giving God the best. You're not giving God the first. And that, so.
Yeah, I think that connects really well to with what Peter mentioned earlier, that we can say, and there's this idea that, hey, I'm not going to be generous now because if I build wealth, then I'll be generous later. Well, you will be no more generous with your wealth than you are with your poverty. And you don't know that you're going to have a later. And I'm all for making prudent decisions for the future. That's a good thing to do. But we can be excessively prudent and we can use our wisdom and our prudence to justify stinginess and selfishness. And we can be so committed to our plan to build wealth so that we can do some grand and glorious thing that we forget that we may not ever get to that grand and glorious day, but we can be generous with what God's already given us right now. Sweetheart?
I think that it can apply to our time also. I know as a mom, sometimes you think like, well, in this season of my life, maybe I can't serve the Lord, but someday I'm going to, and my kids will serve with me, but if we haven't set up the patterns in our life to sacrificially serve already, then we aren't going to.
That's really good. Absolutely. Anyone else? Yeah, so she said that oftentimes, she said as a mom, you can think, well, I'm going to just really focus on my kids and I'm going to prepare them to serve the Lord someday. But it's the same thing, the same principle that applies to our money applies to our time. If we're not serving the Lord with our children now, then we shouldn't expect that they're going to start serving the Lord magically at some point down. She didn't use the word magically. At some point in the future, that we need to incorporate sacrificial service for others now so that they catch the spirit of serving. Because otherwise, we're just perpetuating. They're always going to be doing what we're doing, and we're not actually going to be doing the things God has called us to do. Julie. Oh, sorry. Brother Pastor Scott.
I think there can be a tendency in, like you mentioned, Pharaoh's wisdom was not fearing the Lord, but we can try to check a box saying that we're looking for wisdom, say, in wise counsel, and we can seek wise counsel from people, and then they give us biblical counsel, and then we go and decide we're going to do what we want to do anyway. So we check the box, we got wise counsel, we can tell people we got counsel, but we didn't follow it.
Yep.
I think that's the thing to really caution.
Absolutely. Anyone else? Moving forward in verse... Also in verse 10, Pharaoh says, lest they multiply and so get them out of the land. So make no mistake about it. I'm going to talk a lot about, I've mentioned a number of times, the anti-creational agenda of Pharaoh. Well, here is where we find Pharaoh has set himself against God's agenda, God's creational agenda for Israel. God's plan for Israel is they will multiply in the land and they will get up out of the land. And Pharaoh stands against God's agenda and says, no, I'm going to stop Israel from multiplying and I'm going to stop them from getting up out of the land. This is not going to end well for Pharaoh. Genesis 46:4, I will go down with thee to Egypt and I will also surely bring thee up again. And Joseph shall put his hand on thine eyes, So Pharaoh is setting himself, he is leading his people to set themselves against the creational order, because God's creational plan was be fruitful and multiply. Israel is the heir to that creational plan. And God's plan is for them to create a new Garden of Eden to get back to the creational purposes in the land of promise. And Pharaoh is saying no. And the Egyptians fall for Pharaoh's flattery. And they go along with this plan of oppression. And you may wonder, what are all the plagues about? Why did the Egyptians suffer so many terrible plagues? Well, the Egyptians had all gone along with the oppression. Maybe some of them thought it was a bad idea, but they didn't oppose it. They went along with Pharaoh's plan. They were willing participants in the oppression. And later on, potentially even their children or grandchildren, depending on how you work the chronology out, or great-grandchildren, a little bit later on, their descendants were going to reap the consequences, and they were going to be unwilling participants in the just judgment of God. And that happens. If you go along with pretended wisdom that sets itself against the creational order, God is going to deal with that. And the consequences may be a lot greater than you're calculating. Well, as I had mentioned, I had originally planned on getting a little farther, but I was suspicious that we actually wouldn't. And as it turns out, we actually didn't. So we'll go ahead and stop there at verse 10. And so any final questions or comments before we wrap up for tonight? All right. You are dismissed.